name is Autumn Gonzalez, she, her pronouns, and I am a volunteer community organizer with a group in Sacramento called NorCal Resist.
Awesome. Do you want to just talk a little bit about NorCal Resist and the work that they do?
Yeah, so NorCal Resist kind of started around the time that it became pretty clear to folks that Trump was going to be our president, and the biggest part of his shtick was going to be attacking immigrants, attacking people of color, and attacking queer communities. So we, as a kind of local, broad left coalition of folks, decided we needed to get together and start creating some defenses going into this new period. And it started out sort of as a coalition group with labor and different organizations, and really sort of just boiled down into a group of folks unaffiliated with organizations. We sort of like shed all the coalition parts of it, and it became its own thing. And the first thing we did here in the Sacramento area was to stand up an ICE hotline, which is basically a number that folks could call if an ICE raid happened, to bring out trained, basically like a cop watch program, but specifically for immigration raids. So we trained tons of folks. We had this number going, and then as time kind of passed and we started talking to folks on the line and started getting the word out about our organization, we just became really plugged into other needs in the community, both from the immigrant perspective and just from like the general community perspective. So we started building other programs to meet needs that we were hearing about that in our view were not currently addressed by other community groups or other more formalized programs.
And today we're going to be talking about the work that you all are doing with asylum seekers in Sacramento, California, which is the capital city of California. And also just really picking your brain about attacks on immigrants, migrants, asylum seekers at large, and sort of just how that's kind of playing out in the ground. I mean, Sacramento's been one of the cities that Republican politicians have literally been busing people to from the border itself. So we're going to be talking about how that has played out. But, you know, I just really want to start off by picking your brain. I mean, like, when you're going about your day and you hear, maybe you're walking by and see Tucker Carlson. Well, I guess he's not on TV anymore, but you see somebody from Fox News or something, and there's a headline about, you know, crisis at the border. Right now we're watching Biden, the Supreme Court, and the governor of Texas square off about, you know, who can, you know, militarize the border and run it the most draconian way possible. I mean, what are your thoughts when you hear that talk about crisis at the border? I mean, what do you see happening right now?
Right. I mean, I honestly roll my eyes because it's just so disconnected from the reality of the world we live in. It's a manufactured crisis. It's not a crisis. There are people in migration, but in our world, for forever, people have always migrated. That's just part of the human experience. Yeah, there are a lot of bad things happening in the world right now. And when bad things happen in the world, in order to care for their children or to find a better life for themselves, or, you know, for whatever reason, people do make the very tough decision to pack their life up and move. And that's not something anyone that I've ever met in my entire life does lightly. I mean, you know, we all know how difficult it is just to like move apartments, but to move your whole life to another country is incredibly difficult. And it's a choice folks make really like when there's not a lot of other options for them. But that being said, there's not more people moving around today than there are in any other point in time in history, or in any other point in time from the point which governments and scholars have collected data on this stuff. And I think I saw an article recently that said it's about 3% of the world population that in any given day, time, is a migrant. So that's been just the stable number, like, throughout history. So I see people trying to scare people who live in Iowa and the, you know, these places where they're completely not impacted by any kind of migration, trying to scare them about the idea that white people in this country are going to be replaced by brown people. And I just roll my eyes because it's so ridiculous and it's so detached from the reality. So.
Do you want to just talk about how this is playing out on the border? Like, my understanding is that people are there and they're, like, presenting and then they go through the asylum process, but then there's also, like, this app that people are supposed to get on. Do you want to just talk a little bit about how this is, like, actually playing out on the ground?
Yeah. So it's kind of ironic that because the Republican Party in particular has pushed out this message that if you get to the United States, you get free healthcare and free housing and free food and free this and free that. That message doesn't just stay within the confines of American media. Like, that message has gone out to the world. There's a lot of people in the world right now who have very serious misinformation about what happens when they get to the United States border. So folks are traveling from Venezuela. They're traveling from Afghanistan, Ukraine, Russia, all over the place, places where people, you know, have serious crises happening and are trying to find a way to support their families and be safe and live peacefully. They're making these months and months long journeys, a lot of it by foot, and they're coming to the U.S. border, and they want to comply with the law. Because they're under, in part, well, I think in part, you know, people just generally want to do, like, what they perceive to be the right thing, and that would be, you know, presenting yourself at the border. But also in part because there is this vast amount of misinformation out in the world now, and we have, like, TikTok and all these other social media platforms that are pushing those messages, propaganda from conservatives out into the world. So people are coming to the border. And they're thinking that they're wanted here and that there's going to be help for them. So they get to the border and they try to present, because that's the legal way to apply for asylum is to present at a border. And I do see sometimes on Twitter and places like that, people saying, well, people should come the right way, but there literally is no way to apply for asylum from your home country. You have to get here. So people get here, they come to the border, and like you said, they have to deal with this new app called CBP1, which is like any app that our government manages to roll out is just riddled with difficulties. It's hard to use, and it's hard to use on a phone. But anyways, it kind of gives people the opportunity to sort of like check in and have an opportunity to present at the border in like what I guess our government considers an orderly fashion. And I can tell you that before CBP1, before COVID, we used to go down to the border, and the way this was done was it was an informal system where, like, one of the migrants waiting in this line, which is now kind of a virtual line, waiting in the real world line, had a notebook, and people, like, entered their place on this notebook, and the migrants themselves would keep themselves organized, and then CBP would call certain numbers of folks through each day. And it was just such a disaster, such a ridiculous system. But anyways, people come through when they have the opportunity and when they're allowed to come through. Like, this is all metered, and it's not like our government doesn't know these folks are here. They completely do. But they get maybe placed in detention for a bit. Maybe not, and that part of it, maybe there's some internal logic to it, but that is not something I personally understand. We see people who had to go through detention for months and were like waiting, and then we've seen people who were processed through like in a day or two and got to continue on their way. So it's to me, it's completely opaque, but perhaps there's some logic there. So once people come through and they're on the U.S. side, there are a series of mutual aid orgs, nonprofits, churches, all kinds of folks on the U.S. side, just like there are on the Mexico side, assisting people. And one of the things that they assist with is helping people travel to their next destination, should they have a next destination. And the vast majority of people who immigrate to this country, generally speaking, like, have family here already. They, like, know someone. They have a cousin. They have a tia. Like, they have somebody that they can go to. So they're not just, like, entering and, like, don't have a plan. They usually have some kind of plan. That being said, it's become a little different. We're seeing different people, right? Because there's different crises now happening in the world. So the Afghan community is not as established here as, obviously, like, the Mexican community. Like, I have relatives in Texas. I have relatives, you know, like, all over the place. I would have a lot of options if I was a person crossing from Mexico today. But, like, a Venezuelan person, because we don't have, like, a long history of Venezuelans immigrating to this country, like, there's less of a network, right? So people are crossing. They're coming to these mutual aid group shelters and stuff, and they're kind of feeding them and keeping people warm and things like that. And then helping them onto their next destination by bus, or sometimes by plane if the person's family can afford a plane trip or whatever.
I just wanted to ask how this is happening, because our understanding is that the Biden administration has also extended the Remain in Mexico policy, or the policy in which people crossing into different state territories have to apply for asylum there before they essentially get to the United States. So somebody, for instance, like traveling from, say, Honduras or something, would have to apply in the countries that they cross before they get to the United States. They can't just say, like, I'm going all the way to the U.S. and I'm going to pass through Mexico. They've got to, like, apply for asylum in Mexico, get rejected, and then go to the U.S. that way. So essentially extending the power of the U.S. border throughout these various states, and then like the president of Mexico is working within that context, and then they have like a new police force there to crack down on migrants. Can you just speak a little more about that?
Right.
Like, I'm curious how some people can apply for asylum, and it seems like a lot of people just get stuck, like, in places like Tijuana, waiting on that app. Our understanding is that some people are waiting a really long time, and then other people are getting picked up, and then they get processed pretty quick, and then they actually get into the U.S. So how does the person sort of get stuck or kind of get fast-tracked?
Yeah, those are all really good questions. So obviously the government of Mexico is completely a partner in crime with the United States government, and whatever the current policy is, they 100% are going to enforce whatever it is. So there's certain folks from certain countries that are just not going to even be allowed to get to our border, because that's what the party line is right now. Like, if you're Haitian, the chance of you being able to get through is like minuscule, because they've decided they don't want Haitians here right now. Generally.
Haitians, of course, being largely black folks.
Yeah, Haitians being black folks. And yeah, in our experience, African migrants from all kinds of places have really, really tough times even being able to make it through to ask to request asylum. So there's parts of it that I would trust what the folks who you've talked to down in Tijuana are telling you. The policies change a lot, and they change pretty constantly. And we work with a lot of immigration attorneys and attorneys at the border, and they will tell us things like, well, they're letting folks in at the blah, blah crossing in Texas, and it's not unusual for us to encounter people who had to wait for months and months in Tijuana or in another borders situation for the CBP1 app to tell them it was their time when they could come and cross. And how, who's making those decisions? Like, it seems like sometimes it's just the port itself deciding what they feel like doing that day. And sometimes it's ICE or USCIS CBP policy. And that policy changes like from week to week. They seem to have numbers, like thresholds for people, like how many of that kind of person they're going to let in. And those numbers seem to fluctuate and change. So it's very, I don't know, like from my vantage point, it just feels overall very dystopian and in many ways difficult or impossible to understand. But I'm also like, that's not necessarily the part of the system I interact with as much. So there are probably people out there who could better, you know, explain it than I can.
And I guess part of the other thing that we should really talk about too is that, I mean, you for instance brought up Haiti. I mean, there's obviously a lot going on in Haiti right now, and there has been, you know, for a long time. But of course, the instability there is directly tied to U.S. policy, U.S. imperialism. And the other big thing that's happening is Venezuela. What's happening there? There's huge economic crisis. Lots of people are trying to flee the country there. And which is ironic, too. I mean, like, we talked to one mutual aid organizer on this show from New York, and they were saying, like, it's disgusting and ironic at the same time that all these Republicans are attacking Venezuela as this, you know, communist country. But of course, you know, when these people try to flee the government there and come to the United States, they're met with nothing but like racist, you know, hatred and just veneration. So can you talk a little bit about that? Like, where are some of the hot spots that people are coming from? Because I mean, it's directly tied into U.S. policy. I mean, there's like economic sanctions, is my understanding, against Venezuela right now, which is one of the big things that's driving the crisis there, which is causing people to want to come to the United States.
Yeah, I mean, when we started doing this work, most of the folks, and that was like the late 2018, 2019, we were welcoming a lot of folks from Central America. And now I would say the biggest population of folks that we welcome here are Venezuelans. And then after that, it's Afghans. And then it's Russians and Ukrainians. So it's definitely changed a lot over time. And it is completely 100% tied to global crises and U.S. foreign policy and what the U.S. is up to in the world. And we see it also reflected in our statistics for our bond fund. We have a pretty big ICE bond fund that post bond for immigrants from around the world. And we can always look back at the last year's numbers of like where folks were coming from. And that you can just tie it directly to the current events of the time and like where the crises were happening. So
I was going to talk about this in a little bit, but I mean, you brought up Ukraine. I mean, I think the other really ironic thing is that, my understanding, 300,000 Ukrainians have been brought into the United States as refugees directly over the past couple of years, since the United States has been sending literally billions of dollars for the war there. And of course, there hasn't been any sort of national conversation around like this being a crisis, or quote, there's no more room, or that, you know, they're going to be used to like flip a vote or something like that. I mean, they were just, you know, it's none of that talk is there, of course, because these people are presented as, quote, white.
It's racism, and it's hard to like justify it any other way. It's purely racism. And that's pretty, it's disappointing and pretty disgusting, but you know, even at the end of the day, our government really doesn't treat even the people that it quote unquote wants to come here. It doesn't treat them well. So even the Ukrainians don't have it very good, which is, it's pretty sad. But yeah, I mean, obviously I don't know what else you could point to besides race.
Well, let's talk about this thing that's been happening over the past, I guess it's been the past 2 years, in which Republican politicians have literally put people on buses and then shipped them off to, quote, blue cities or Democratic strongholds. Basically, how did people start to arrive in Sacramento? Was it in part through these kind of publicity stunts by these Republican politicians, or other ways, or was it both?
Yeah, definitely both. The first set of Venezuelan folks that we housed and assisted, were still here in Sacramento and are part of our mutual aid programs and are great guys. They were victimized, and not, I don't want to call them victims, but they were the subject of action by ICE. So basically what happened was rogue CBP officers down at the border thought it would be cute to put this random city on these guys' paperwork, even though they had no intention of coming here, this group of like eight Venezuelan guys. But they didn't really have any big plan. Like, they thought, oh, we'll go to Miami or we'll go to New York because we know there's a lot of Venezuelans there, right? So that was their plan. But at the border, the CBP officers assigned them to court here in Sacramento and basically told them, you have to go to Sacramento. And they were lucky enough that a nonprofit down at the border in Texas helped them to get on a bus here. But the paperwork they were given told there was a shelter in Sacramento waiting to welcome them. And when they got here, they walked from the airport to the address where they'd been told there was a shelter, and it wasn't a shelter. It was a Catholic Charities office in a building that was actually pretty much empty because of COVID. Like, everybody was teleworking. So security guard at the building told them where they could go to the food bank, to get some food and clothes. And the food bank called us and was like, hey, we have this group of migrants here who could really use some help. And we got them into hotels and stuff. So we had that happen. And that was just kind of like an individual action by CBP officers. And from talking to attorneys down at the border, that is not an unusual thing for them to just mess with people like that, just because they have the power to do that. And, so they mess with people. We've also had charter flights come from Texas that were paid for by, I want to say, Governor Abbott, but maybe it was the other guy. But those folks were lied to and told, hey, like, we're going to give you this trip, this flight to Sacramento. And when you get to Sacramento, there's a job waiting for you and housing, and it's going to be great. So you should definitely come. So this group of 30-some Venezuelan, mostly almost all Venezuelan folks, they're like, hey, that sounds like a great plan. I came here to, make a new life. I'm going to go take this opportunity. And they did. And obviously they got here and they were again dumped. They were dumped at the Catholic diocese, in part because I think there's a problem on the right with the Catholic Church being, generally speaking, pro-immigrant. They're not happy with that. So there's a lot of like punishment happening of the Catholic Church. But they were luckily able to get housing. The diocese like paid for some temporary housing. And then after a couple months, we took over that situation with a refugee resettlement organization. We rented a couple houses and we've been helping them with food and, like all the stuff you have to do when you're here. You've got to keep in touch with ICE. Like, you have check-ins, you have to go to the immigration court. There's all these responsibilities that folks have if they want to stay current in the process. And so we've had people show up both ways. And then we've also just had people, end up here. They knew they wanted to get to the United States. They didn't have like a really solid plan, like what was going to happen after that. They're just kind of like, one step at a timing it. And we've had some of those folks end up here in Sacramento, and we'll get a call from like the airport or a bus stop, saying, hey, there's a new family here. They're not really sure what to go. Sometimes they call our hotline, and then we'll go pick them up and we'll get them in a hotel and get them a meal and then kind of plan next steps from there. So definitely multiple kinds of ways folks are ending up here in Sacramento.
Yeah, I'm curious if you can say anything else about like the folks that are literally put onto buses or other things by Republican politicians. I mean, it seems like in some of these instances they're not even being told where they're going. They're just kind of like packed into somewhere and then they're just shipped off. I mean, that's kind of the narrative that's been reported on. I don't know if that's true.
I mean, from the conversations that we've had with folks, it sounds like somebody made contact with them, someone who it sounds like was hired by one of those governors, who tells them, like, hey, if you agree to get on this flight or this bus, like you're going to go somewhere where we have jobs and housing for you. And I think that just kind of gives them the plausible deniability that they're not, quote unquote, kidnapping people, that people are going of their own free will, but they're going based on a lie. Pretty much everyone that we've talked to who's experienced one of those charter buses or flights, that's basically been what happened. And it's just so ugly to do something like that to someone who is already so vulnerable and in such a, I mean, when we meet people, they have their backpack on their back and the clothes that they're wearing, and in their backpack is like maybe their, you know, death certificates of their parents and birth certificates of their kids and their own birth certificates and like basic paperwork, like your emergency stuff. And that's all they have. Like, that's it. Like, to be in that vulnerable of a position and to have people like manipulate you like that, it's very hard to understand, for me at least, to understand how someone could do something that really ugly. But that's what's happening.
Talk a little bit about the work that you all are doing. You mentioned that people contact NorCal Resist. What's some of the organizing work that goes into supporting folks once they arrive in Sacramento? You know, what type of stuff are you guys doing?
Well, I mean, when it started out before COVID, when we started doing this, we basically placed folks in volunteer homes. So like, just the average person could reach out to us and say like, hey, I'm interested in being part of this network. I have a spare bedroom or, you know, whatever. Can we talk about it? And then we get to know the person. Like, obviously we want to vet folks and make sure it's a safe landing spot for people. And that's what we were doing. And it was a good experience for us. I think it was a good experience for our hosts. And we learned like a ton. It was just such a learning experience about, like what this looks like building a program like this. And then I think we probably would have kept going down that road and then COVID happened and people just, you know, obviously it became much scarier to have a stranger in your home, especially since a lot of our hosts were, retired folks, older folks, you know, maybe with some medical vulnerabilities. So it just became a different thing. So we had to shift, and we shifted to renting motel rooms, which we like right now. We have 11 motel rooms filled around town. So we do that, and people stay there for like 2 weeks to a month. If we're really in a housing crunch, maybe 2 months. And we pay for that, and we make sure that usually the motels that we use have like a little kitchenette so people can cook and, you know, like kind of feel somewhat normal. Motels are not, you know, they're not the best to the home, but we try to move towards getting people into their first apartment. And what we do is we basically look for really, really affordable apartments, and we will pay the down payment, the deposit and the first month's rent, and kind of walk through with the family, like, this is what you're signing up for, and this is what the responsibility is going to be. So, you know, if people aren't feeling ready for it yet, that's fine. And we're like, you know, these are other options if you're not ready for that. But most people are, like, they really want to get the normalcy back into their lives. So they're really excited to, like, get into an apartment, have a safe place for their kids to sleep, and then start looking for work and get their kids enrolled in school and just kind of do all that stuff. And we just, I mean, really, if you told me like a couple years ago we'd be doing this, I'd be like, that sounds ridiculous. Like, how could we do that? But we've just through trial and error and really like learning on the go have learned how to like get people like enrolled in school and get kids their vaccines, and where's the best place to go for that, and where's, you know, who's the best contact for this thing that we need. And it's really been just like a total, like, very grassroots, mutual aid oriented, like, someone that you know will know the answer to that question and we will figure it out kind of project. And so we've gotten really good at it. So we can house like a ton of people at once, and we can welcome more people, and we're not scared anymore about like a big group coming, because we're like, yeah, we can handle that. Whereas like if you told me a couple years ago that we'd see groups of 30 or 40 people come up, I'd be like, well, there's no way we can deal with that. Like, we will be crushed. But now it's just like, yeah, like, we've got this. We know what we're doing. And our community has just, like, stepped up in such a big way. And people are so supportive. And they're proud of the work that we're doing. And they want to see it continue to grow. So it's just been such a good experience. And it also feels like it could be replicated in other places. And it also kind of could be replicated in another context. Like, it could be a disaster response program, or it could be unhoused assistance. Like, it does not necessarily like a model that's only for responding to this immigrant situation. So that's been really cool to know that we can really assist folks in a lot of different contexts if the need arises for us to do that.
You said be crushed, like, in terms of just like not having enough resources to
help
people. People are leaving Venezuela and they're coming here. I mean, what do they make of like connecting with a group called NorCal Resist, and then, you know, a space that has no war but class war on the inside of the, which is awesome, by the way. I mean, what do they make of sort of the political nature of the organization?
It's funny because, you know, at like, a lot of the migrants who are on the move right now are really young men, and some of them are like, you know, they served in the military, like, they're not necessarily like politically, you know, maybe not politically awakened at all, but definitely not like coming here being like, oh, I'm super left wing, you know, but they love what we do and they want to be part of it. And now like they will put our stickers on their cars, and they're like super proud to be involved with it because they see that it's not like some bureaucrat somewhere like saying, oh, here's your like $20 ration of food or whatever. It's like, no, all these people are coming together and we're seeing what we have available, and we're going to try to, you know, take care of everybody, and there's a role in it for you too. And like some of the guys that we've welcomed who've been here for a profile. Like, one of them, he worked on cars back in Venezuela, so he's become a big part of our auto light repair. And some of the guys, you know, just, they have other skills that can plug into other places in our program, and they love doing that. And I think I think it's made their landing just so much softer to, like, have this built-in community of those of us who've, you know, are born in the United States or lived most of our adult lives and here in the United States. And then a bunch of folks who are in the same situation as they are, even though they might, you know, be from Afghanistan or be from Ukraine or Russia. Like, it's really cool to see people, even if you come to one of our events, like, there will be like 5 different languages going. And we will be talking across languages and communicating with hand signals and stuff. And yet everything happens and it gets done, and it's like super cool, and it just feels so good. And I know that it feels that way for the folks that are new to the country. So we're just really, like, we're really proud of that, and that we've made that happen.
Are they aware of the depth of conspiracy theories and essentially kind of like what's being said by powerful people about them, and that, you know, George Soros is paying for them to come here to, you know, kick out all the white people and stuff? I mean, I'm just curious, you know, the degree in which they're kind of aware of how much of a boogeyman they are right now, and what they think about that.
I think they are. I mean, like, obviously every person has a different level of literacy of, like, how much they spend listening to media and stuff. I would say a good portion of folks really are aware, and they do see that stuff, and they kind of just find it to be comical, because it's so contra to their entire experience. Like, they're not stealing anybody's job. Like, you know, they're doing their best to survive and hustle. They're trying to follow the rules that this government set forth for them to follow, which are completely ridiculous and completely, like, bonkers to try to follow, but they do their best. Like, so they see those things, and, you know, they kind of are just like, where are these people getting this information? I would say, like, a lot of the Afghan folks that we deal with, I think feel some disappointment, because many of them have someone in their family who worked with the United States government while the U.S. was occupying their country. And they were sold a big, you know, like, the U.S. government is forever grateful to you, and we're going to take care of you, and, you know, like, you'd be welcome in our country, and we'll get, you know, and then they come here. And if they weren't evacuated out with the airlift, they've come up through Latin America. Like, they did the many miles, many months walk. And they get here, and there's nothing for them. There's no help. There's no welcome. There's no thank you for your service. And I've seen people, like, be pretty broken by that. Like, to see that the U.S. government does not live up to their promises.
For people from Afghanistan, you're saying they literally had to come to Central or South America and then basically make that horrible trek up into the U.S. border. Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah.
So there's no process for them? Like, they just can't go to the U.S. embassy or something to be like, hey, I want to come to the U.S. Like, I'm here to, you know, reap that reward that you talked about.
Yeah, no. And I mean, you see some of these folks is because we run these self-help asylum clinics where we help people get their asylum paperwork filled out. And you see some of these people's resumes, and some of them were like very, very high up in the chain of government interaction with the United States government and military. And you're like, wow, you all just left this person behind when you knew this person was just, like, on the list. and now they got their family here through Colombia and, like, coming all the way up. And then you are not even, you know, not even to help them, like, with some housing. That's cool. So yeah, it's pretty disgusting.
You know, there's a couple articles about, the work that y'all are doing and just the way that people are living when they get here, one of the things that we're seeing a lot about and hearing from different folks is a lot of folks get here and they sort of kind of fall into like the gray economy where they're doing gig work or they're working under the table doing like construction jobs. Talk a little bit about that, because it's interesting that there's this still this kind of narrative, which I don't see how anybody can believe, that migrants or asylum seekers are, quote, stealing people's jobs, but then there's so much work that is available for them because, especially, you know, in the midst of the pandemic, there's been this growth of gig work and everything like that. So talk about, you know, kind of the work that, that people kind of awaits folks once they get here, and what does that say about what's going on right now?
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely doing odd jobs. They're working in construction. They're working DoorDash. They are doing all of these, you know, like you said, like gray economy, under the table, whatever they can find, back of the house in the kitchens and, you know, janitorial work, places like that where employers are willing to kind of turn the other way because they have all these jobs that need to be filled, but they can't seem to find workers. So it's so frustrating because people come here and they don't want anything for free, whether or not, like, I mean, I personally think people should get things for free, but they don't want things for free, and they're very proud, and they're like, I came to this country, I'm not seeking a handout, but to make a better life for myself, and I want to work. Like, we've literally had people try to start looking for work the first day they got here, and we're like, whoa, like, you need to, like, sit down, relax, eat this meal, you know, decompress a minute, and then we'll worry about you finding work. Like, we've got you. But, like, that's how people, like, that's the mindset of these folks. But they can't even legally get a work permit until 6 months after they've applied for asylum. So, you know, we do our best to get people through our self-help asylum clinics as soon as we can, but it has a wait list of 200 people on our list for the asylum clinic. And every other legal services organization in our region who does free or low-cost immigration legal services, they have wait lists like thousands of folks long. So people have barrier and barrier and barrier to try to be able to work legally, which is what they all want to do. And what are you supposed to do? You're not eligible for CalFresh. You're not eligible for cash assistance. You have to work. So yeah, like, people go and they find work wherever they can, and they tap into the network of folks who are already here that we know, that they know. And they start working wherever they can. And a lot of people are doing stuff like DoorDash and going to the Home Depot to look for a day job in construction or something like that. And it's most of the time it turns out okay, but, like, it's, you know, we've had not uncommon for people to come to us and say, hey, yeah, I, like, put in a full 10-hour day with this guy and he gave me like $30. Like, what do I do? And, you know, we explain to them what their rights are and all that stuff, but you can never track these people down. So they get, you know, they get taken advantage of in that way too. And it's really frustrating and so unnecessary.
What's your understanding about, like, kind of like the differences about what's being proposed in terms of what the Democrats are talking about and the Republicans?
I think I speak for most folks who work in the immigration field as organizers or attorneys or whatever, that it's just consistently disappointing to see the Democrats be willing to trade the rights of immigrants away to the Republicans for these not even wins, but to just let the conversation continue to shift further and further right until we're not going to have an asylum program at all in this country. And we're going to endanger so many people's lives for what? Like, for these victories that are not really victories. So, I mean, I think everyone's just, you know, I mean, not surprised. Like, who's surprised that the Democrats are weak and ineffective, but just consistently disappointed, because I like to think that there are many people out there who perhaps they don't have the ideology that I have, but, like, maybe on some basic basic principles, we could agree that immigrants deserve to be treated humanely, and that this country needs immigrants, and that that it's unrealistic to think that we're going to close this country's borders. But instead, there's a vocal minority of white nationalist, racist folks who have been allowed to completely conquer this conversation to the detriment of all of the rest of us. And it doesn't feel like we have a political party who's willing to stand up.
Why do you think that is? Why have they conquered the conversation? It seems to be that they're just really good at diverting people's anger at the situation and presenting like an easy scapegoat. You know, as easy as that kind of rolls off the tongue, that seems to be what it's about. You know, whether it's like trans people or houseless encampments, it seems to be this narrative that there's not enough to go around, and here are these people that are coming to take the few crumbs that you have. You know, you better watch out. I mean, it's like that classic cartoon of the boss of the capitalist looking over at the white worker saying, like, hey, that brown person over there wants to take your cookie. Meanwhile, he has a plate of, like, 1,000 cookies or something like that, or owns the cookie factory would be more realistic. Right. But, yeah, how did we get here, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like you're just 100% right on that. Like, we see this consolidation and further consolidation of wealth in this country and really around the world that I think has been, you know, we've seen this expedite in a post-WTO globalized world, where we decided to allow capital to do whatever it wants, whereas workers are locked into these borders and all of these things. And I just feel like it's a total distraction move. Like, while we're over here stealing the cookies, you all, like, fight with that guy because he's black or he's brown. And it doesn't feel like there's, I mean, like, I guess at the end of the day, both political parties are indebted to the folks who are further and further consolidating their wealth. We don't really have a two-party system in this country. And so there's no one to really speak for the rest of us in the political sphere. And which is why many of us, you know, don't really feel like that's a place to even spend our time. Because it feels like a rigged game. It feels fruitless. Whereas organizing on the ground with like-minded folks feels like a place where you actually can build some power locally, and like everything starts locally. So.
Right. And I think this is the reason why this organizing is so important, especially right now, because, you know, regardless of your opinion about like voting or whatever, I think the reality is that this election cycle is going to cause a lot of people to be looking at the border and asylum seekers as, you know, this existential threat to themselves. And that's the role of social movements to really push back against that and to really kind of like recenters people's vision and to remind them that, you know, you're not getting evicted by somebody that's trying to come over here and work for DoorDash from Afghanistan. That's the people that actually have power and wealth in this country, and they've been here for a long time. So I'm curious, you know, I guess, you know, another bigger question is like, you know, what do we do to kind of like to do that, to have that conversation with people and also to really push back against the reactionary and racist voices in society that would try to use these people to really further their fascist agenda. Because, I mean, I think 2024 is going to be defined by that conversation.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I mean, our philosophy as an organization, and we're a big tent, multi-tendency organization, folks from all kinds of political orientations broadly on the left. Our orientation has always been to like be in the community and to give folks the opportunity to meet folks that they otherwise might not ever talk to or know, and get to hear their stories and get to see what they go through on a daily basis. So we have this program that we call the Accompaniment Program. And basically we go out to churches and schools and community groups, and we train folks on the basics of this process, like, you know, the immigration process and what new arrivals face. And then we say, okay, you're going to volunteer to, like, go with that person to their ICE check-in. You're going to volunteer to go to the grocery store with that person. You're going to volunteer to, like, do all these things that need to get done. And in the process of doing those things, relationships and friendships get built. And also people get a firsthand look at, like, how absolutely ridiculous the immigration court system is and the ICE process is. And I feel like when you have had those firsthand experiences, you're just in such a better place at the Thanksgiving meal or whatever to talk about it with your family members who are, like, you know, Fox News watchers, because you're not just regurgitating talking points that you saw on some other channel. You can be like, hey, no, like, I've actually, you know, I know a family like that. And let me tell you, like, this, nobody's giving them anything free. You know, like, you heard that on the news, but, like, I know people and I help them, and I can tell you, like, that's just not real. And I think that the more that we create these community networks and bonds where people feel like real investment, because it's not just the my team versus your team, Democrat, Republican thing, but it's like, wow, I actually care about these folks and this matters to me. I just feel like that's the power building, but it's also, you know, it's slow and it's a lot of work, and, you know, it's, you know, not easy work, but I feel like that's really where we are, is we have to be doing that work, because we, you know, we don't have access to TV channels or whatever. Like, this is where our power starts, is people to people.
So folks are listening to this and they live in a community where people are coming to or perhaps being bused in or something like that. What's some advice that you would give for what people could do to start to organize?
I would say, like, plug in with your local mutual aid orgs that are already doing this work, because in pretty much all of the large cities, Chicago, D.C., New York, there are big and really well-run mutual aid orgs that are doing very similar work to the work we do. And we watch what they're doing and we see the good stuff and we try to replicate it here. There's a lot of information exchange happening. So I'd say, you know, plug in. And if you live in a smaller, like, a mid-sized place and we didn't have anything, you know, find a crew of friends, and just start, like, hanging out at the bus, the Greyhound, every once a week or something, you know, like, doing something like that. And we used to have this program where we'd be at the Greyhound and we'd have, like, little packs of, like, sanitary stuff and snacks and sometimes, like, blankets and things like that, for the migrant folks who are coming through our bus or who were stopping here. And that was really, you know, it wasn't a hard program to do. Like, a small group of people can do something like that. And then as you start learning and talking to folks and understanding the issues in your community more, you can kind of start building out in the ways that make sense. But, like, everything's got to start small. And I don't think anything is too small. Like, whatever you and your friends can do, like, it's worth doing it, because it's going to make a difference to the folks that you encounter.
If Trump or somebody like DeSantis comes in and wins, I'm curious, you know, how much worse do you think it would get?
I mean, I think they could end up trying to completely shut the border down, which basically will push people into these more and more dangerous routes, like you were talking about, like trying to cross rivers and deserts. And we'll see more people die. And I think it's unnecessary and horrible. And I think that's very, very possible. And then I think, like, groups like ours who do this kind of work will, like, when these kind of things happen, we see an uptick in, like, threats and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it's gonna be bad for all of us. But I just, you know, I feel like we all have to keep moving forward and, like, shining a light on this stuff. And as things change down at the border, we have to adapt and be prepared to do what needs to be done.
Any closing thoughts? Anything else you want to talk about that we haven't got a chance to go over?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I guess just, like, my parting thought would be, like, that this is such I didn't know anything about immigration until I started doing this a couple years ago. I was really someone involved in a very different part of the movement. And it's just been so rewarding and so, so good. And I feel like, you know, it can sound intimidating. I guess really any kind of activism can seem intimidating from the outside, but, you know, you learn, and it's okay to go into things without being an expert on them. So that's really my parting thought.
Awesome. Well, if people want to follow and support the work that you all are doing, where can they go to get more information?
The website is norcalresist.org, and then we're on Instagram and Facebook and X and Threads, all under the NorCalResist handle.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us, and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.